Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the Son of a Pitch podcast. I'm your host, Michael Cuenca, and today we have a truly captivating episode in store for you. In our conversation with the remarkable Vera Hoffman, we explore the profound lessons that can be gleaned from the experiences of raising children and caring for them. Vera shares with us her journey as an au pair, taking care of three children in Paris, and the invaluable insights she gained along the way. Through their eyes, she discovered a whole new perspective on what truly matters in life. The importance of embracing different timescales, understanding the significance of seemingly insignificant moments, and realizing that the things we consider important may not hold the same weight for others. We also discuss the impact of these lessons beyond our personal lives. Vera enlightens us on the power of seeking diverse perspectives and engaging in dialogue with those who have alternative viewpoints. By doing so, we can challenge our own assumptions, break free from the constraints of our socialization, and discover new possibilities for personal and societal growth. Join us on this thought-provoking journey as we explore the transformative potential of stepping outside our comfort zones, embracing the wisdom of children, and reevaluating our priorities. Prepare to expand your horizons and gain a fresh understanding of the world around us. Sit back, relax, and get ready to embark on this captivating episode of the Son of a Pitch podcast. Let's dive in and explore the extraordinary wisdom that children and unconventional experiences have to offer. Vera, it's a pleasure to have you on the Son of a Pitch podcast.
Thank you very much for having me. It's a pleasure to be here with you. And I'm very curious where our conversation will bring us.
Indeed. You never know. That's the crapshoot of life, the universe, and everything, right?
So, That's right.
But why don't, just for curiosity's sake, you tell me a little bit about what kinds of things in your life right now bring you joy?
Oh, what brings me joy?
Start off with a little Marie Kondo.
Yes, that's good. So what brings me joy is just basically really like the cup of tea in the morning, being really mindful about that, I guess. What brings me joy as well is our neighbor's cat, which comes by very regularly asking for a cuddle fee. That brings me joy. What brings me joy as well is seeing the really goodwill of dear colleagues and friends in really creating a better world, despite all the challenges that we're facing these days. So I guess that very much brings me joy, to just name three things.
So tea, someone else's pets, and happy colleagues.
Happy colleagues, and maybe another, and not only happy colleagues, but really kind of colleagues which join efforts to help creating consciousness, better work conditions,
right,
etc. And also kind of thinking about, so how can we, and that was of course kind of what brought us in the first place together, our conversation topic that we wanted to explore, to really think about, okay, so how could we kind of create a better tomorrow, regenerative places, different ways of consuming, changing habits, etc. So that's really the thing that gives me hope, I guess, as well. Not only joy, but also hope.
Yeah. And I mean, forgive me for being the perennial cynic, but there's plenty for us to not have hope about. Why does that particular thing, regenerative futures, why does that have... What does that speak to you particularly?
It speaks to me because I think what comes to me, like also with regards when you're kind of being cynic about hope, I once learned from in a book by Brené Brown, you might have heard about her, that hope is not an emotion. Hope is a strategy. So hope being... knowing where you want to go, so having a clear goal, even though you might not know whether you really reach it, but believing that you can, and then developing strategies, building up on your own resources that you have in mind of how you will get there. And I think that's very much also why is that particularly of interest to me, exactly that. I think if we like seeing the big picture, and I absolutely agree with you that there's plenty of things where we kind of could be desperate about, it is kind of an imperative to be hopeful in these days, I guess. That's at least how I see it.
Is that a chicken and egg situation? Like, does one need to put, let's say, if we were to equate hope with, you know, positivity, good vibes, that kind of aspiration towards goodness, if you will. And I'm paraphrasing. I have no idea.
Yeah. Well, I think...
How would you define hope?
So hope is, I think, like, it's, you know, like, of course you can kind of say good vibes, all that kind of good stuff. And we need kind of comfort also to some extent, I think, in these days. But, or something that feels comforting. But it is also very much about not only kind of finding refuge or flying from the kind of maybe also challenging facts, but finding a good balance in that, you know, like finding a good balance between taking good care of ourselves and each other and creating the vibes that are nourishing us. Maybe it doesn't have to be about good vibes and being superficial, but what is nourishing you in order to gain the energy and gain the momentum and the stamina to also work on the things that are actually very much worrying. So I think that would be for me this strategy aspect of hope that also Brené Brown was referring to. Mm. In a way. Yeah.
And how do you do that?
How do you do that? I think it's about community. I think in...
What do you mean?
It's very difficult, I think, to be hopeful by yourself these days. It's, I think, kind of the big changes that are demanded of us in that time, whether it's about kind of on a political scale, on an economical scale, on the scale of how we are consuming, etc., that they are just too big to be dealt with by yourself. So it's about community in the sense of asking for inspiration or looking for inspiration. How are other people doing that? And then starting whatever is inspiring you in terms of effort that you can do yourself, not only by yourself, but together. So maybe one example that comes to mind that I found very powerful and joined forces in a way myself with, when I realized that my own relationship to money as an entrepreneur needed a little bit scrutinizing, and there was something to be explored, but can be a scary topic in a way as well, can't it? I found actually an offer of a course, which was not about 10 steps to become a millionaire, but really kind of digging into that topic, which at least for me was a very vulnerable one as well. And doing that in community with other people who are similarly curious, but maybe also a little bit like, okay, what does that mean? And that was, back then it was about 2 years, three years, I think ago, a course by the company is called Conscious You. It's founded by Nadia Stetanchevsky. And the course is called See You Money. So become conscious you, being conscious about money. And in that, really kind of digging down, sharing the stories that make us feel vulnerable, in that finding community. And from that, I entered actually in a community where Nadia herself was as well, which is very much exploring about, okay, so what is money? What are we doing to money? And what is money doing to us when we are not conscious about it? And what could money become if we would loosen up or become aware of all the histories that we are connecting to it based on our cultural background, our family background, etc. And from there, kind of deciding, okay, if money becomes a means to create really change that we want to see, whether it's now in the social context or it's in the environmental context, how could that look like? And doing that together with that community. So that's kind of one thing how that could look like.
And why was money a vulnerable or touchy subject for you as an entrepreneur?
Well, in a way, isn't it? Like, it's only about, of course, I share about me and everybody else who's listening kind of can touch upon that one for themselves. But it's a vulnerable subject because I think we connect both positive things with money. Some of us connect with it freedom to do certain things. Some of us connect with it comfort. Some of us connect with it maybe the possibility to become creative. But it also can carry, and in my case, that was also the case, it can carry these connotations of money makes people, for example, corrupt, or I don't want to, it's in a way kind of, it, whenever it, I go in an exchange with money and I have to fight for certain things, then it becomes uncomfortable in a way. Or the question of if I'm going to put a certain price label to the work that I'm offering, and it's not something like that you can justify because of, this is the amount of soil that you kind of put there, and this is the amount of water because you're growing certain crops or certain things, but it's more connected to yourself. Then it's also the question of, so do people see whether this is, whether the work that I'm doing is worthy? And you can very easily also go into that realm where it's about, am I worthy? So you're kind of entangling for reasons that you maybe don't even understand until you're digging deeper into it. You connect your own self-worth with the money that you receive as an entrepreneur very easily.
Did you find yourself doing that?
Absolutely. Absolutely. And the moment that you kind of do that, it becomes very hard to ask for money. So really going deeply into that context and finding out, oh, but money is something that is separate from me, and I can ask it for certain things that I'm offering, and it's really nice if it's flowing in, but my self-worth is independent of any money flow that is kind of coming and going out of and into my life.
So you were kind of conflating the remuneration you would seek with your sense of self-worth. Am I hearing that right?
Yeah. And I think, yeah, at least for me, that was back then, that was very much the case. And now it's changed, obviously.
How so? Yeah.
That is this beautiful process that you go through when you're realizing that you're projecting certain things on money. So the work that we were going through in that course, and that I'm going through ever since, and can highly recommend anyone doing who is interested in that topic, is realizing that when I, for example, say, let's take this, what I earlier said, the connection of money is freedom, and then I replace, the idea behind, maybe a little bit more of context, the idea behind this course is that we're kind of constantly projecting certain things into the future, into the past, on certain objects, on certain ideas, etc. And right. One of them being money, right?
Right.
And we're doing that largely unconsciously based on the history that we are carrying with us and what other people have told us about certain things, or maybe experiences that we had in our childhood or that our parents had and we were taking over from them. And the moment I become aware of that and I go into the emotion that comes with it of that projection, being able to just experience that emotion And then going through the process of detaching myself, knowing that I can live with that emotion and without that emotion, with that label, without that label, that's a very powerful one. And that happens in that process like this, that I see what I'm projecting on money. For example, I could fill out, I had both positive and negative projections. So I could say like, okay, money means freedom for me. Okay, money is freedom. I am freedom. And what does that feel? That feels very positive in a way. And then I would go to the other side. So what is the opposite polarity of freedom for me? It's unfree, or it's, and it can be, by the way, very subjective. It can be imprisoned. It can be tied together. It's a very subjective thing that happens.
Why is money freedom for you? Was that something particular to what you've come to associate with money, or what was the, to what extent do you associate money with freedom? Where does one get to that association?
So back today again, I can see it differently, but back then, 3 years ago, it would be very much like, so if I have this and this amount, I can do whatever I want, right? This is kind of and I think that's actually it was for me like this, and it's a very common thing that basically also our society tells us in a way, doesn't it? So if you
scroll through TikTok, you'll see all the side hustles that make people X amount per month to buy their freedom. Yeah, I can empathize.
And once we realize, you know, like, I mean, there are certain people which kind of build up this enormous richness only to realize they don't feel much freer than they did before, because it is in a way a connection that they made based connected to money now. So freedom is not with them. It is tied to that money in a way. So I have to disentangle freedom and place it back into myself in order to experience real freedom with and without money. And that's, of course, so that sounds probably very, very abstract, but once you've kind of gone through that process and it's very much like, okay, you say like, I am free. And then you see, how does that feel in my body? You know, and it can be a very beautiful feeling, but it can also feel like a lie in a way, because you've been always attaching it to that object, you know, in that sense, it was money. And then you would say like, so what is it? I'm free with and without money. So how does that feel? And go to the other polarity. I'm unfree, and see how that is pulling me back into the money thing. And kind of play with an embodied feeling of between being unfree and free, and feeling well enough in both sides in order to let kind of to create really that freedom without money and with money, because it's not something bad to have money on your bank account, obviously not. But it's kind of in how far are you attaching certain feelings, and is it a conscious choice that you are making, or are you running behind it unconsciously? And I think kind of that brings us also back to the other topic of sustainability in a way, and or regenerative. As long as I'm running behind it, how can I make regenerative choices in a way?
I'm kind of curious, before we move to the sustainability element of, you keep mentioning that your previous perception was money was tied to freedom.
Mm-hmm.
What, 2-3 years ago you mentioned. Mm-hmm. What happened between then and now? Did you have to struggle with anything? Was there any sort of, in a lot of cases when people, in my experience, entrepreneurs or just humans really have to move from one perceived negative trigger association with emotion, they need to go through like some very uncomfortable truths sometimes. Absolutely. Or some very uncomfortable situations. Did you have to experience something like that? What, how did you get from that perception to what I imagine now is slightly more, I guess, enlightened than that?
Relaxed, at least. Let's
Real, at least chilled out. Yeah, than that sort of a, yeah.
It's the realization that, you know, both freedom and unfreedom are just part of the human experience. So I cannot 100% be always free. That would actually also be really unhelpful in my, in the social context in which I'm living in. You know, if you're completely free, there's no, or there's lesser kind of maybe also motivation to do things that are uncomfortable, but that are ultimately good for the larger, for the larger kind of environment in which I'm in socially, or maybe also with regards to the planet. So it's good that I'm unfree, that I'm living on this planet and have to experience the consequences of my actions. So I, in that sense, I'm unfree, and that's really good. And I'm free to do certain things and to just trust life in a way that it takes care of me. For example, also if I'm doing good work that is impacting positively the humans around me, they are more likely to, for example, also refer me to other clients, to other colleagues, etc. So with and without money, I'm both free to do certain things and unfree all the time. So it's kind of moving between a little bit like a lemniska and going in that kind of not having to all the time hunt for freedom, because sometimes I will feel more free and sometimes I will feel very unfree. And that's both okay, maybe even really good. Yeah.
It's kind of interesting because you're familiar with Rousseau. He, Jean-Jacques Rousseau, in his book, The Social Contract, the opening line is actually, in the beginning, man is born free and everywhere else he is in chains, implying that we enter into a social contract essentially with each other by living and thriving in and amongst other people that has its own mores and norms and situations and contexts and associations and everything. But deep down, almost akin to the poets and Enlightenment level poets when they talk about the fall, the great Enlightenment process from the naivete, almost nascent beginnings of people, and what we are now, presumably in the Enlightenment age. I'm probably bastardizing the centuries of human development and Enlightenment, but essentially, do you think it's a product of the environment and context in which we live that encourages people to make these kinds of false associations with like sort of seeking money, seeking reward, seeking some kind of sign of value that we then inevitably or unfortunately conflate as our own self-value? And like, is it, it's sort of, again, back to the chicken and egg situation, is this us doing it to ourselves? Or is it the world and construct and context in which we live right now, the zeitgeist, the style of the times, that makes these associations so powerful and so personal? Like, at which point do we have to say enough? You know, I guess, yeah.
It's a both end, right? I mean, we were born in a certain context. We've been, except for if you want to assume that your soul chooses to enter life at a certain point in time, there has been no choice. You've been born in a certain time, into a certain family, onto a certain place on this planet, and in this context, money always played a role, and we've been designing. So yes, we as human, I mean, money is a human construct. It doesn't grow on trees. It doesn't fall from the sky. So we've been basically creating that system. So yes, it's us. And it's also up to us to change it in that respect. But that means that, and there we are with something that you said before, that we have to become aware of how it's driving our behavior first, because how can you change something if you're not aware of what it's doing to you and how it's functioning in a way.
Right.
So, and I think like we are actually living in a really interesting time, because we realize in many ways that, and we have with, I'm really not an expert in cryptocurrencies, but there are more and more alternative currencies are coming up, which will give us the opportunity at one point, to some extent already gives us now the opportunity to choose another money system. The question is, with which level of awareness are we creating a new level, money system? Are we taking the same kind of projections? So more is better. There is not enough for everyone. And I have to be as quick as possible to get whatever I can take in order to, for example, secure my existence. If that is the mindset with which we are creating also the new currencies, then we are basically just replacing one thing, which is actually kind of making us feeling struggling all the time, by another one. If we are aware of what is happening and in which world we will live and we want to live, and maybe also bring certain other aspects that have until now not been in the context of our economy, for example. The donut economics, which actually basically kind of gives these incentives to kind of take Earth and the limits of our planet into account, into the economy. And if we find a way to find to create a currency system that does the same thing, then we have a chance to get out of the cycle, I guess.
What do you mean by donut economics for those that are unfamiliar with this? Yeah, I mean, so, they're experimenting with it in Amsterdam. I know that much, but.
Yeah. So what I understand from the donut economics is basically that Kate Raworth, who has been putting it in place, says that there are kind of both on, so people can fall from the grid, and or also kind of other stakeholders, planet Earth, for example, can fall from the grid, either if we're overshooting over certain limits, or if we're not taking care of certain people and parameters, basically fall short. So there's both a there can be a too much, for example, too much CO2, too much plastic, too much whatever. And there can be a too few, for example, with regards to care for equal pay, care for immigrants, etc. And she says basically donut economics would be if we would stay within certain boundaries and exchange all the goods and services and money flow within these boundaries to keep the system healthy. That's basically what I understand from the donut economics. So,
well, what Wikipedia understands it to be, because Lord knows Wikipedia is the source of everything truthful. Essentially, what it says here is that donut economics is a framework for sustainable development that combines the concept of planetary boundaries mm-hmm. with the complementary concept of social boundaries. And so it's the blending of the social foundations and ecological ceiling, where between the two provides us humans the ability to thrive. And beyond it, you're using too much, or you're harming the environment. So things like climate change, ozone layer depletion, land destruction or conversion, biodiversity loss, those things take place. And in the inside, the shortfalls of social foundations would be like lack of access to clean water or food or healthcare, education, social equity, gender equity networks, et cetera. So that there's a somewhat of a economic, eco-social, I guess, balance in the middle that allows for humans to thrive. And it kind of, it accelerates the need for a, I guess, a foundational basis of looking after each other, almost Maslow-esque kind of fundamental need states, coupled with breaks on our innate nature to overconsume and overindulge, I suppose, on things that we could do more with less, or we can do. You don't need to eat that extra portion. You don't need to, you know, destroy another acreage of land. You can find ways to be more efficient with what you have, etc. So when we first spoke, you and I, Vera, you mentioned that beyond, or at least within the scope of donut economics, there's this space where there's kind of like a, you mentioned like a piece of the puzzle where we as humans can find a way to live with a certain new version of comfort in a slightly different way than what we have it today.
And that, I guess, very much goes along again with the psychological process in that respect, I think, which is defining in a new way, what is actually comfort for me? Is it kind of, what am I projecting, for example, on money? What am I projecting on being able to consume so much? And kind of looking behind the myths that were told to us or are being kept, we also keep on telling in a way, kind of if we're working in these big companies that kind of want us to consume. So there we are again with the economic system in which we are. It's in a way kind of both understanding that this is our reality and not kind of finger pointing on certain people, but then also asking, is that really it? Or what is comfort for me? What is comfort, like I said earlier when we started, is it maybe the cup of tea and drinking that really mindfully and knowing these people around me that are doing good together with me? And the cat, like in a way, the natural surroundings, isn't it? And that's just, of course, that sounds really profane. Is that a word actually in English? I'm not sure.
Profane, but I think, is indeed a word.
Yeah. But I think,
what did you want to mean by that?
In a way, too simple. That's what I mean. But I think kind of basically I could even ask you, what makes you kind of, what is comfort for you in a way? That maybe would be also an interesting question to ponder upon.
Yeah, it would, but this is my podcast and I'm kidding. What's comfort for me? On a fundamental level, I've always strove. I always sought to create a happy, healthy, and respectful home for my kids, for my wife, for my family here. Those three pillars, essentially, happy, healthy, and respectful, are essentially my, I'd say, foundational levels of what comfort is. Anything beyond that, like happy, healthy, respectful, and I own a private jet, that's cute. It's not necessary. Happy, healthy, respectful, and I got a Lamborghini in the parking lot. I don't actually need a Lambo, but you know, anything beyond creating an environment where my kids and my wife and even my dog can thrive and feel happy and healthy and comfortable and respected, I think it hasn't always been the case for me, at least. I used to be, some may say I still am, but I used to be quite an asshole. I used to be quite tense and aggro and really irritated by the difference between almost the grass is always greener on the other side kind of thing. I would always look at what other people would have. I had the same challenges as you did, you know, where I conflated service provision with personal value. especially as a freelancer, it's really hard to separate those two. You know, you're not working for like a company that's, you know, Widgets Incorporated. It's like, you know, Michael Inc. or Michael BV or whatever you want to call it. It's still you. They're still calling you. And so it is hard sometimes to separate. I recognize where you're coming from, that it's sometimes hard to separate oneself from one's self-worth and from other people's self-worth. But perhaps, maybe this is age talking. I guess the older I get, the less fucks I give about what other people think. And I just focus on doing good work and creating a comfortable life for myself and my family, which again revolves around the themes of happiness, health, good health, and a respectful environment. But, you know, this, it was the product of, as you mentioned before, going through some pretty uncomfortable truths.
Yeah.
Going through some pretty challenging situations and some really good therapy, you know, and then coming to a place where you realize that it's going to take a lot of work. It's going to take a lot of focus and efforts. And like you mentioned, recognizing those triggers that lead you to respond in a certain way emotionally and adjusting, or at least growing out of old triggers, old habits that you may have, that I may have learned at least from people like my family, my social construct, my environment, coming from a very, you know, sort of ghettoized part of Montreal. I had my own biases. It's that, I think, overcoming our own cultural biases and upbringings and associations that came with that, at least for me, that had shaped my perception of what comfort was or what I should aspire to. And then now it's shifted to more of a, I guess, homeostatic, equilibrium focused, almost basal level of health, wellness, respect. You know, things like, am I sleeping well enough? Am I drinking enough water? Am I looking after myself? And then can I look after the other people around me like that? You know, it's like in the airplanes where they're like, a sudden depressurization, we'll drop the mask down and make sure I put it on you first before you go and put it on and take care of the rest of your family. And I always thought that was weird until I realized, if you can't take care of yourself first, if you can't take care of getting yourself sorted, you can't actually take care of other people.
That's right. And I think kind of a lot of, like, if I thank you, number one, for sharing. And I think that kind of a lot of us come basically, if we think long enough and maybe get good enough questions from people who care, we come to a similar conclusion in a way. You know, comfort is basically about health, about being in a sane and healthy and caring environment and doing our part for that in that respect, and then the rest basically drops, as just you said, you know, behind that it's something that maybe is nice to have, but in the context in which we are living in right now, maybe also, yeah, maybe something to be redefined. And that, of course, is up to everyone themselves to decide on that. But if we think about, and you've been talking about also about your children, I think children are also a wonderful way, the next generations, to really kind of make kind of a step back and realize, so what is really important, you know?
Right. I usually, when people ask, or at least I have some friends that have just recently become pregnant, and they are like, you know, well, what are children like? You know, everyone says children are like mirrors. And I usually say that whereas a mirror will show you, if you have a positive self-image, I guess, show you how beautiful you are, you know, all your highlights, all your nice bits, or things that you like to see, children have a very unique knack of unique ability, of showing you your shadows, of showing you the areas that you need to work on. You know, when my kids said to me, hey, daddy, you know, when you wake up, sometimes you're just angry and sometimes you're upset or frustrated or whatever. And you know, is it us or did we do something or whatever? And I remember that conversation, just waking up in bed. And I actually said to myself, this is not the environment I want for my kids. This is absolutely not the kind of energy I want to put into the world. And it took some real uncomfortable fighting with myself. I actually literally, when I woke up and recognized that I felt frustrated and angry, repeated, you know, I want a happy, healthy, and respectful home. And did that for a good 2 weeks before eventually the attitude started shifting, the behavior started shifting, the mindset towards the world around me started changing until, you know, like, I don't know who said it, but some thinker out there said, our words become our thoughts and our thoughts become our action and our action becomes our perspective on the world. And that I tried that out. I was like, what have I got to lose? The alternative is waking up being an asshole. So anything in a positive direction is a better stance. And so I figured I'd start repeating that mantra, which then became a perspective, which then became an attitude on the world, which actually inevitably influenced how I interacted with people. So yeah, children are powerful mirrors, but sometimes even more powerful indicators of the shadow work that one needs to do to be a better person, to go through the uncomfortable and embrace perhaps what you were meant to be about all along.
Oh, beautifully put. Yeah. So what is, if I know it's your podcast, but if I, what has been the kind of the most beautiful thing that your children have taught you in that respect, if you want to share?
No, of course, I'm an open book. I've got nothing. We're all humans. We're all experiencing life at the same time. The most beautiful thing my kids have taught me, patience. They've taught me a unique sensitivity and awareness to time, not just in a very temporal sense, but in a my time on this earth kind of sense. Having kids made me realize that, you know, at some point, eventually, they are going to be the ones going through the same shit. They're the ones that are going to be turning 35, 40, whatever. And I'm going to be the one, you know, getting old. And, you know, hopefully then I'll have the right to be cranky at everyone. They'll just be like, oh, this is that cranky old man. I'll be like, great. You know, I can't wait to be like the cranky old guy where people are just like, ah, whatever. And then I get to yell at everyone. No. The biggest thing they've taught me from the moment that my daughter Sophia was born, she taught me about understanding that to really connect with people, you need to understand the time scales that they work on and adapt yourself to that rhythm, and not try to force your rhythm onto the world. Not try to force your perception of what should happen when, but rather work with the pace and tempo and structure and timing of the world around you if you want to, I mean, this sounds selfish, to get what you want. Like in sales and everything, the best thing to do isn't to tell people what you want them to do, but rather to listen to what their needs are and find common ground, find a win-win dynamic, find a shared ground. You can only do that by tuning into them.
Yeah.
And so patience and a sense of time, a very acute sense of time, is what they taught me.
That's beautiful. That's very beautiful. Yeah. Thank you.
What about you?
Well, I don't have kids yet.
Oh, that's probably why you look so rested.
But I did kind of, maybe the most comparable thing, I used to be an au pair after high school. I went for a year to Paris to take care of three children and to learn the language. And what they've been teaching me is also very much what you, and it's, it was not too much related to time as you are sharing it right now. But one thing that they taught me was that you can not expect from a, or you can expect different things from people in different ages. And that you have to kind of, and that's also the beauty of it. If you go and see the world through their eyes, they have a completely different thing of what is important, what is not important. You know, time frame, in the sense of we have that schedule, and at 7 you need to be in bed because otherwise you're becoming cranky. 3-year-olds after 7 o'clock, forget about it, at least this one that I was responsible for. But kind of taking the time to really see what he had to show me, you know, and seeing the joy in that, and maybe also realizing that the things that you find are important are maybe just really not that important as you think they are, or they are for you, but maybe not for that, for that child. And it, it gives you an opportunity to rethink what is really important, you know? So
do you think those are, there's some lessons that can be applied to how we are in a professional setting or in like our day-to-day lives?
Yeah, I think for sure. In the sense of, you know, there we are again, we kind of, when we grow up and we've been kind of taking enough of the socialization, infiltration, whatever, you know, like seeing, okay, important people think that this is important, okay, then I find that important as well. That maybe from time to time, talking with people who are completely not in that world, like children, would be really good to see whether that is really of relevance here right now. I mean, not for nothing, children are asked regularly by kind of like filmmakers and people who are making documentaries about how they see the world, because they basically maybe have in mind what is really essential. And I think we can ourselves also do that. Or in another way, what I love to do with my clients is kind of, if they are open for that, really bringing in someone completely different from that field and just asking questions, you know, because by that, bring in a couple of kids, but also maybe kind of bring in whatever artists, you know, yeah. and let them maybe paint or draw whatever, what they see, or do that together with the clients. So they also gain a new perspective, because in everyday life, we so quickly are kind of digging our way into how we think the world is. And maybe sometimes a change of perspective in that respect can be really helpful to see what else is possible. Yeah.
So it sounds like there's this question about how we as humans move, I guess, both individually and collectively within a certain bandwidth as humans, which is one way would be more in line with the natural boundaries that we have there than others. Is there some sort of in your opinion, or at least in your experience, or at least in what you do, is there some things that people could do to help them move more in line with these natural boundaries? Is there any sort of things that one can apply or can do to make them more attune to these this bandwidth of thriving, I guess, to play on the theme we're talking about?
Yeah. Well, there are two things that are coming to mind. Number one is really carving out from time to time some time to really reflect with other people that you care about, but maybe have completely different ways of seeing the world, and talking about the times that we are living in, and from that perspective, what they are doing, and what you are doing, and kind of inspiring one another to try out certain things that are maybe different in terms of consumptions, in terms of actions taking, in terms of so many other things that can be, yeah, that can make a difference. And also with regards to maybe also in that respect, sitting down and seeing like what are the solutions that are around me here right now, you know? I mean, here in where I'm living, there are such great initiatives about kind of local growing of foods and crops and teaching for children. There we are again, you know, in that respect, but also for adults, and kind of taking one step at a time to really kind of dive into these possibilities and see whether they are actually also fun in maybe a different way and meaningful, because I think that's also one of the things that can drive our behavior towards living more within these boundaries of our planetary and social health, kind of what is giving meaning in a way. So that's what's coming to mind.
So kind of like an outside in perspective, getting someone else's perspective to shape and color and sense check yours, I guess. And then you also looking in and seeing what fits and works for you within a wider construct as well. So again, there's this interplay between individual sense of self and an awareness of the collective, of the social grouping. Do you think that kind of awareness, I mean, I should have asked this before, where are you from, by the way?
I'm originally from Germany.
Okay. Yeah. Now, is there, culturally, is there that inclination towards being, I mean, you guys are like godfathers of philosophy and a sense of awareness of self. I mean, Heidegger is propping up something in my room. I'm pretty sure of it. But this, do you think that because of, you know, where you grew up makes one more attuned to the social dynamics or one's place within society? Or do you think this is a pretty, not generic human experience, but something we all inevitably have to go through?
I think we are living in, obviously, I think it's of course a question of privilege in a way. I mean, if you have to work, I don't know, 17 hours a day to feed your family, will you have the time to think about these questions? Maybe, maybe not. I think we here in our Western context, a lot of us, not all of us, have a much better chance to kind of really think about these topics as well. So that's number one. But I think kind of in the time that we're living in, that's kind of a lot of us are thinking about that. So I don't know whether that's something that is specifically to the culture which I'm coming from. I think in general here in Amsterdam, in the Western Europe, well, basically all over Europe, we're thinking, and maybe worldwide, we're thinking about that right now. So,
interesting.
Yeah.
Cool. Before we wrap up, I wanted to know, is there anything that you'd like, are there any sort of resources or things you'd like to point people to, or maybe even your own professional sites that might be interesting for people to check out if they want to learn more about your thinking and what you're about? How can we find you? How can we learn more about Vera and how we can connect or whatever and grow that
wonderful connection? Very happy to do so. I mean, one thing that if the money kind of topic and the consciousness around that, which I very much would like to highlight, is this this course out of my own experience that has really helped me in my own entrepreneurial steps and success in a way. So that is the See You Money course by Nadia Stratanchevsky. Another thing that I
see you as in SEEYOU money, or
C like ABC.
Yeah.
And so the third letter of the alphabet, and then U like the, I don't know how much of letter of the alphabet. Yeah. See you and
so money. The letter C, the letter U, and then money.
Exactly. 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 So it stands for conscious you, basically. So
obviously.
So that is one that I want to highlight too. There's for the, well, very much actually diving into kind of the work of Kate Raworth for the donut economics, if people are interested in that. For those who are happy to face hard truth about kind of the planet, there's also a beautiful book by Kimberly Nicholas, Under the Sky We Make.
Under the Sky We Make.
How to Be a Human in a Warming World. And and then if you want to find me, I'm very happy, then that's there, www.daretoimagine.today. Or finding me on LinkedIn under the name Vera Anna Hoffmann. So, and I'm very happy to connect on that and spin any ideas forward.
Cool. So, well, I'm sure one of my six listeners would be happy to reach out to you and say hi. No. Vera, thank you so much for taking the time to share your thoughts, your experience, your unique perspective on the world. Really appreciate it. I know I've learned a lot. Didn't expect to be interviewed halfway through, but I'm open and rolling with that too. You asked some really good questions and this was a nice conversation. So thank you so much for that. And
thank you. Thank you for your time, for that beautiful conversation, your good questions, and making that happen and having these great conversations, inspiring people. That's wonderful.
Awesome.
Thank you.
Well,